Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So we're on Canto 4, Chapter 28. Paranjan becomes a woman in the next life. And we're doing texts 5 through 7. And I think that's 7 on the board, so I'll just read the first couple of verses, then we'll chant text 7. So text 5, translation: when the city was thus endangered by the soldiers and Kalakanya, King Paranjan, being overly absorbed in affection for his family, was placed in difficulty by the attack of Yavanaraj and Kalakanya. Purport: when we refer to the body, we include the external gross body with its various limbs, as well as the mind, intelligence, and ego. In old age, these all become weak when they are attacked by different diseases. The proprietor of the body, the living soul, becomes very sad at not being able to use the field of activities properly. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly explained that the living entity is the proprietor of this body, Chaitragya, and that the body is the field of activities, Chaitra. When a field is overgrown with thorns and weeds, it becomes very difficult for the owner to work it. That is the position of the spirit soul when the body itself becomes a burden due to disease. Extra burdens are placed on the body in the form of anxiety and general deterioration of the bodily functions. Text 6, translation: when King Paranjan was thus embraced by Kalakanya, he gradually lost all of his beauty. Having become too much addicted to sex, he became very poor in intelligence and lost all of his opulence. Being bereft of all possessions, he was conquered forcibly by the Gandharvas and the Yavanas. Short purport: when a person is attacked by the invalidity of old age and is still addicted to sense gratification, he gradually loses all his personal beauty, intelligence, and good possessions. He thus cannot resist the forceful attack of the daughter of time. And text 7, which is on the board: Vishirnam Swapurim Viksha Pratikulan Anadritan Putran Potranugamatyan Jayam Cha Gatasoridam Vishirnam Swapurim Viksha Pratikulan Anadritan Putran Potranugamatyan Jayam Chagatasoridam.
Yeah.
devotees. Vishirnam scattered. Swapurim, his own town. Viksya, seeing. Pratikulan, opposing elements. Anadritan, being disrespectful. Putran, sons. Potra, grandsons. Anuga, servants. Amatyan, ministers. Jayam, wife. Cha, and. Gatasauridam, indifferent. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. King Paranjan then saw that everything in his town was scattered, and that his sons, grandsons, servants and ministers were all gradually opposing him. He also noted that his wife was becoming cold and indifferent. Purport. When one becomes an invalid, his senses and organs are weakened. In other words, they are no longer under one's control. The senses and the sense objects then begin to oppose him. When a person is in a distressed condition, even his family members, his sons, grandsons, and wife, become disrespectful. They no longer are under the command of the master of the house. Just as we wish to use our senses for sense gratification, the senses also require strength from the body in reciprocation. A man keeps a family for enjoyment, and similarly, the family members demand enjoyment from the head of the family. When they do not receive sufficient money from him, they grow disinterested and ignore his commands or desire. This is all due to one's being a kripana or miser. This word kripana, used in the sixth verse, is in opposition to the word brahmana. In the human form of life, one should become a brahmana, which means that one should understand the constitutional position of the absolute truth, Brahman, and then engage in his service as a Vaishnav. We get this facility in the human form of life, but if we do not properly utilize this opportunity, we become a kripana or miser. A miser is one who gets money, but does not spend it properly. This human form of life is especially meant for understanding Brahman, for becoming a brahmana, and if we do not utilize it properly, we remain a kripana. We actually see that when one has money but does not spend it, he remains a miser and is never happy. Similarly, when one's intelligence is spoiled due to sense gratification, he simply remains a miser throughout his life. So, this is the proof that we're not God. We have to grow old. And everything goes out of our hands. Anybody can see, it's very simple, but still people are so foolish, being overburdened by a misguided intelligence, that they think that somehow or another there's some advantage to be had even up till practically the last breath in this body. A couple of days ago I read about one girl in England. So she's lying, she's got some malfunction of the body, so she's in this kind of what they call locked-in syndrome. Can't move. Everything is depending on machines. That's the only reason why she's apparently still alive. Apparently. Not necessarily the only reason. But she wants to die. She's just living on the machines, can't move, can't do anything. And the parents, they wanted to live. So they've been telling the doctors, you keep the machines going. She's telling the doctors, no, I don't want the machines anymore, let me die. So it went to the Supreme Court or the High Court. And then they finally gave a judgment, yes, you can switch off the machines, let her die. So as soon as the judgment came, she immediately changed her mind. Now she wants to live. So this is illusion. Yeah, they can't separate themselves from the body, even when the body is simply a burden, not only to themselves, but to everybody else connected with that body, the family members. And then, therefore, when the person who was formerly the breadwinner, as it's mentioned here, or any member of the family, there's a reciprocation going on, that they give some enjoyment, they receive some enjoyment. It's a kind of a pact for sense gratification. But as soon as one person is unable to fulfill their side of the business bargain, then immediately they become rejected and despised. That we're not getting anything from this old man or this old woman. And in return, now we have to dedicate so much of our time and energy and all our hard-earned money for doctors and, you know, home care and this and that, and put them in an old folks home and pay through the nose. Yeah. This is the business that's going on in the material world. And everybody becomes very resentful. And practically speaking, most of the family members are simply hovering there, waiting, let him die, then I'll receive this much, I'll get the house, I'll get the car, or, you know, I'll get some share of the money, etc. So they're just waiting. Yeah, now he's old and useless, let him go. Nobody cares anymore. And they're very happy when they die, because then they'll receive some further investment in their sense gratification. And where that person goes, having spent his whole life working very hard and doing, in many cases, abominable activities, creating offenses against many other living entities in order to support the family and keep their sense gratification maintained at a desirable level. Now, when he's leaving the body, where he'll go and the reactions that he has to suffer from all the activities that he's performed in his life of sense gratification, oh, that's all right, let him go. We don't care. Nor do they even know, actually. Yeah, they convince themselves that after this body is finished, everything is finished. And so what difference does it make? Yeah, therefore, you have this idea of euthanasia is also coming in. Yeah, they're already killing all the little babies. Why? Because that will be a hindrance to our sense gratification. To have a baby, economically, very difficult. So we want sex, but we don't want to put up with the consequences of it, which is another life. Another addition to the family, another mouth to feed and clothe and educate and all the rest, and what to speak about, all the emotional investment that goes into having children. So get rid of it, that's all. And rationalize it scientifically, so-called scientifically, that there's no harm, it's just a blob of tissue. You just remove it, that's all. So in the same way, now the other end of the scale, at the very beginning, life is not viable. There was an article a few months ago by some so-called professor, one lady, she was arguing the point that actually, not only is life not viable in the womb, yeah, they're not proper people, yeah, they're not independent. It's not viable even up to the age of 2 or 3 years old. So if after you've had your baby, you discover there's some problem, and it's become a burden in one way or another, you can kill it. And it's cited that in so-called previous other civilizations like the Greeks and the Romans, sometimes they would do that. They would have a baby and then decide they didn't want it. They'd take it off into the mountains and just dump it. And whatever happens, happens. So in the same way then, you know, there is a precedent for this idea. We're not coming up with something new. Nobody should be horrified. Actually, great civilizations like the Greeks and Romans were also doing this because they were practical people. So maybe we should consider killing even the little babies, no problem. So that mentality is there at the beginning with an anticipation of burden. And then at the end of life, when the actual burden is manifest, yeah, now the breadwinner or the mother or, you know, old person can no longer make a contribution to our sense gratification, kill him. Give him some extra injection, some, you know, cocktail of drugs, knock them out, and then just give them an extra dose of this or that, and they'll slip away. Yeah, no visible sign of any discomfort. Actually, it's merciful. It's a great act of mercy to kill a person who's going to die anyway, and there's no reactions, there's no, you know, contrary aspect to it. It's actually good for everybody. They're suffering, kill them. We don't suffer anymore, they don't suffer anymore. They don't understand actually the real position. They don't understand that that soul that's in that body carries with him his body and his subtle body of mind, intelligence, and ego. And therefore, even when they die, they continue to suffer. Actually, even more, many, many times, especially the karmis. Gross, sinful people. Not religious. They can do anything and everything. So even when they leave this body, actually the suffering that's observed at the end of this final stage of the body is just the beginning for many people of the suffering that they're going to have to face after they leave the body. So people have no Brahmagyan. They have no understanding of Brahman, of the soul, the fact that consciousness is actually eternal. And therefore, they can rationalize and do any abominable thing. And, you know, they don't care. They think there's no consequence. They don't care about it. They don't care to think about it. So this is a horrible civilization. Prabhupada mentions that in his Vrindavan Bhajan, he's reflecting. This was written in about 1958, when he was living in Vrindavan, 58 or 59. And he said, I'm simply sitting here laughing. All these family and friends, yeah, relatives, they're all now gone. Where have they gone? Because I have no money, I cannot support them. Now they've all deserted me. So he said, I'm simply sitting here and laughing. And what is this family anyway? Just a list of names. That's all, nothing more. So, in other words, there's no value to be had from this so-called family life, material family life. Everybody's just coming together, Prabhupada describes there, like seaweed or, you know, straws floating in the ocean. And then with the action of the waves of the ocean, they come together. And then after a few moments, again, the action of the waves of the ocean separate them. They never see each other again. And yet everybody's thinking, oh, this family life is so important, it's so, you know, everybody becomes completely absorbed in it. This is their only aim in life. Support the family, get some gratification from it, give them some gratification. If a man can please his family members in a big way, oh, he's considered to be a great personality. Yeah. If he can earn a little extra money and provide them a little bit more facility, oh, now he's a great man. But if he loses that, oh, then he's finished. And nobody wants to know him anymore. So old age is anyway, at least as I was saying, proof that we're not God. We're not enjoyers. We think in a certain stage of life that we can enjoy when this body is fit and strong and the senses are working nicely. seem to be working nicely, and the mind is, you know, expanding, the intellect is developing. So with all these utilities, we think, oh, now I can enjoy, or I am enjoying, or if I'm not enjoying now, I can do in the future. Everybody's under that illusion, and it's very, very difficult to shake it off. It's very difficult to shake it off. But a little observation can prove to us that that so-called enjoyment is just Maya. It's all an illusion. That conclusion we have to come to right at the very beginning if we're to make real progress in the matter of real enjoyment. We have to be able to separate false enjoyment from real enjoyment. We're not against, or it's not that the Bhagavatam is preaching against the principle of enjoyment. Enjoyment is the essence of life. It is life. Yeah? If you're not enjoying yourself, you're not living. But the kind of enjoyment, where we get our enjoyment from, that's another thing. So the Bhagavatam is teaching that real enjoyment is on a different platform from this body, on a different platform from the physical, the mental, and the intellectual. It's on the platform of Brahman, spirit, understanding the eternality of the living being. I was with Prabhupada in Washington, D.C. in 1976. So at that time he was meeting with the founding members of the Bhaktivedanta Institute. And they had developed some slideshow that they were taking around schools and colleges. Swarup Damodar, Sataputta, Madhava Prabhu, presenting the arguments against evolution and the chemical production of life. And Prabhupada gave some final comments after spending 3 hours watching that slideshow. It was a very interesting discussion. Prabhupada gave his conclusion that actually modern civilization is simply, he didn't say dumbing down, but he said it's making everybody dull, like trees and stones. So this is the most offensive civilization. Because people, when they're born in this human form, the soul has the chance to become a brahmana. That was his point, that in this human form we have the chance to become a brahmana, to become aware of Brahman, to understand the real nature of the self. But we are being prevented from doing so by this false educational process run by materialistic persons. Therefore, he said, this is a very condemned civilization. That people are being prevented forcefully from understanding the true nature of the self, that they're spirit souls. And we see that practically. Yeah. As soon as you mention anything about the soul, anything about religion, anything about spirituality, oh, immediately. Yeah. Sentimentalist, crazy man, yeah. Person who has no knowledge. This is the propaganda that's going on. And at the same time, you know, the obvious realities, oh, that's just kind of shunted aside. Growing old, getting disease, dying. They have no idea, actually, what life actually is, what we're here for, and how to be successful in that pursuit of happiness. We need to be happy. We're not happy, and therefore we're pursuing it. So happiness is there, but where it's to be found, that we have to seek it out. And the Bhagavatam, therefore, is giving us that information. Real happiness must be eternal. There cannot be peace in the world unless there's peace in the heart. Peace in the heart comes when a person feels satisfaction. When Prabhupada first went to the West, he had a small pamphlet printed up, and in that, the heading begins, Srimad Bhagavatam, India's message of peace and goodwill. That was how he advertised the Bhagavatam. Peace and goodwill. So that peacefulness comes from knowing the actual nature of the soul, of the self. And then, by acting on it, then one develops goodwill. Goodwill is indicative of a relationship. Peacefulness we have within our own hearts. And then when we're feeling peaceful, then when we deal with others, we can have goodwill towards them. When we're not trying to exploit nature, exploit our own bodies and the bodies of others for sense gratification, then we can actually have goodwill. But as long as we think this body and mind is meant to, you know, be indulged, the senses, material senses, and as long as we see others as a means for indulging in our sense gratification, which we have to do if we're in that materialistic frame of mind, you cannot see any other living being except as a commodity for enjoyment. And if they don't give you your sense gratification, you reject them. You get rid of them somehow or another, or you lose interest in them. There's no goodwill. All the so-called goodwill that's supposed to be there in the world, it's not goodwill at all. It's all based on my interests first, sense gratification and exploitation of other living beings to satisfy and gratify my senses. So all this, you know, so-called ecological concern, altruism, this, that, and the other, what is it all for? It's simply all based on the body, that's all. And it's based on, ultimately, my body. That I get my gratification, and if you cooperate with that, you're okay. Then you're a friend. And if you don't cooperate with my sense gratification, you become an enemy. Yeah, or at least I become indifferent to you. So in this way then, this modern civilization, there's no peace and there's no goodwill. Nobody's peaceful in the heart. Everybody's agitated constantly from one moment to the next. Even if they get, you know, tremendous wealth and riches, different kinds of opulences, the facility may be there, but the capacity is not. I was just in London a couple of weeks ago, and there's a couple of gentlemen that come there every morning. They're very nice devotees. They're billionaires in pounds, not even in dollars. Yeah. They're worth about $6 billion. And they come every day, at least one of them does. Every single day he comes to greet the deities. He stays for the kirtan. Chants, sometimes he dances with the devotees, and then, you know, exactly the same time every day when the class begins, he goes home. So I was thinking, here's a man, he's worth £6 billion. What could you do with £6 billion? He's worth £6 billion, but that was the point. What can you do with £6 billion? How can you increase your sense gratification just by having more facility for it? You cannot, because the capacity remains the same. He's got two arms, two legs, two eyes, a nose, you know, skin. He's got the same set of senses that any other living being has. And the capacity that he has is not increased, you know, when you go from $6 to $6 billion. It remains the same. A beggar in the street, he may be looking in the sweet shop and thinking, if I just had 5 rupees or 10 rupees, I could buy a gulab jam, and then I can enjoy. Right? He's lamenting. All he has is just some flour and water. That's what you see on the street sometimes. The rickshaw wallahs, this is one of their main meals. They just get some flour and they mix it with water and they bake it and they eat it. Add a little salt for some flavor, that's it. Now, if that same man, if he gets, you know, instead of, now he's lamenting he doesn't have 10 rupees, let's say he gets 1,000 rupees or 100,000 rupees or 1,000,000 rupees. So he can go in the sweet shop, he can buy any sweets he likes now, but how many can he consume? 1, 2, 5, 10, 20 gulab jams? 30 gulab jumps, 50 gulab jumps. He's got $6 billion, but he can't eat any more than anybody else can. He can't eat any more than the beggar in the street. He may do it a little more nicely, but the capacity does not increase with the facility. Everybody's got this limitation, and in fact, the limitations are very small. Yeah, if we look at it, once you've got, you know, your 3 meals a day, a place to sleep, a little bit of, you know, sex life, that impulse is there. It can be solved by getting married and having a family. But how much more do you need than that? Therefore, in the Upanishad, it's mentioned there that everybody is given by the Lord, they're allocated a certain amount as their quota. Everybody gets a certain quota if they're well behaved. Of course, if you're not well behaved and you misbehave, you may be restricted. But under normal circumstances, everybody gets the quota. And then beyond that, whatever you get is a burden. You may have £6 billion, but you have £6 billion worth of headaches. How to support it, how to maintain it, how to expand it, how to stop me being, you know, cheated by this one and that one. Yeah, because as soon as you get some opulence, so many people will come, yeah, and become your good friend. So they can see if they can get some advantage from you. So who is a real friend and who is not, nobody knows. This is one of the dilemmas of the so-called rich. They never know who their friends are and who are they not. There was one famous actor from England, Michael Caine. So he was brought up in a very kind of ordinary working class area of London, East London. So somehow or another, he became famous. So there was some interview with him and they asked him, do you still see your old friends? You know, the guys that go to the pub every night and, you know, hang out. Oh no, I don't do that. Why not? Because you never know when they're going to ask you for money. That was his reply. Therefore he said, I had to cut off all my association, all my old friends. Now I only hang out with people that have the same amount of money as I do. So in that way, where is the goodwill? Even you have so much facility, you have name and fame, you have so much money. Yeah, people fall over themselves to open the door and, you know, provide this and that. But at the end of the day, who is actually a friend? Who is Sridhar friendly towards you? And who can you be friendly towards? Nobody. That's the answer, nobody. Everybody's trying to exploit everybody else and get some sense gratification. And therefore, there is no goodwill. But we see Srila Prabhupada, when he used to write letters, he would always sign that, your ever well-wisher. Your ever well-wisher. And he's not only is a well-wisher, but he's a well-wisher under every circumstance. Every circumstance, whether you're down or up or whatever, it doesn't matter. Prabhupada was a well-wisher because he was seeing beyond the platform of sense gratification. He could see the spirit soul. He knew himself to be a spirit soul, and he knew who the actual Supreme Lord is and who actually has the proper capacity to enjoy. We don't have that capacity. You can get the facility, but there's no capacity. And because we don't have the capacity, whatever facility we get simply becomes a burden because we can't maintain it. The reason why we can't maintain it is because we don't own any of it. We're trying to acquire stuff. That means it's not ours. It's coming from somewhere else. We do not naturally own anything. And because we don't actually own anything, even the bodies that we're in, that means the body, the mind, and the intellect, therefore we cannot control it. It comes, it goes. Chanchalam, this is Lakshmi Devi, goddess of fortune. It comes, it goes. And you can't dictate, now immediately give me £1 billion. Yeah. No, when it comes. And if it goes, it goes. And you can work as hard as anything to try to protect your fortune, but it will slip out of your hands. Because we don't own anything. And because we don't own anything, we don't control it. We have no control. And therefore, we are not the enjoyers. You can only enjoy that which is naturally yours. You have the capacity to enjoy what is yours. That's all. So what is our capacity? Nil, practically. There's some capacity for enjoyment, but it does not lie in trying to increase our possessions and in trying to satisfy or gratify these bodies and the senses of these bodies, which we also don't own. It lies somewhere else. It lies in recognizing Who is the actual owner of everything? Who is the actual controller of everything? And who is therefore the actual enjoyer of everything? And therefore Krishna says, Bhaktaram Jagnatapasam Sava Loka Maheshwaram. I'm actually in control of everything. I'm the actual bhakta, the enjoyer. Yeah. And on top of that, he says, Suridam Sava Bhutanam. That's a natural consequence. That you can actually be a well-wisher of all living beings when you're fully satisfied. When you have nothing to take from anyone else, then you can be a well-wisher. But if you're always seeing everybody else as some means for increasing your own gratification, you're not a well-wisher. Yeah? A well-wisher means giving, that's all. It means giving and sharing what you already have. So Krishna is the only enjoyer. He's the natural possessor of everything. Everything that we see is Krishna's energy. It's not ours. And we ourselves are also Krishna's energy. We're not independent. We are dependent. So recognizing our dependence on the actual owner, the actual controller, and the actual enjoyer of everything brings about a state of peace. Shantim Man, what is that? Gyatva Mam Shantim Richati. Gyatva Mam, you know me, Krishna says, as that controller, enjoyer, possessor. Then you become peaceful. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is telling us how to become peaceful, and when we become peaceful, then we can have goodwill. Otherwise, it's not possible. But therefore, when Prabhupada wrote that, India's message of peace and goodwill, the Srimad Bhagavatam, he knew, he had realized what the real purpose of life is. Brahmagyan. Yeah. Knowledge of the Supreme Absolute Truth. And that knowledge sets you free. It sets you free from all of this distress, all this lamentation that comes with old age, disease, and then finally getting booted out of this body. Dragged out. Very horrible. For a person who has no knowledge, it is simply painful. Life is simply painful from beginning to end. Because ignorance is the greatest of all diseases. Yeah, whatever these diseases are that's been described here, Prabhupada goes into some detail, you know, hearing aids and, you know, even having to get some aid for passing stool and urine. So many things, you can't breathe, your lungs clog up, your ears clog up, your eyes fail, all these things. These are only symptoms of the disease. The real disease is ignorance. This body itself, Prabhupada says, of course, is the disease. The malfunctions of the body are simply symptoms of that disease. But that disease itself is indicative. Accepting this body is indicative of the real disease, which is ignorance. Not knowing who we are and misidentifying the self with something false. This material body is a false construct. It is created by Maya or illusion. The elements are there, but the combination of them in this particular shape and form, that is an illusion. It's not true. It's not a truth. And if we base our lives on trying to fulfill our pursuit of happiness with a false construct, then what will be the end result? We end up with nothing. Yeah? If you approach something which doesn't really exist to try to get some satisfaction from it, then when that thing, you know, is taken away, as inevitably it must be, then there goes your happiness also. So if we want to be really happy, if we want to be really peaceful, and then from that develop genuine happiness, we must come to this knowledge of the Bhagavatam. So this story of King Paranjan is very instructive. Our living being becomes bewildered by attainment of this body, becomes overwhelmed by false notions of the self. And then at the end, you know, describing how actually we become cheated. Yeah. All the things that we've invested our time and energy and consciousness in, will all let us down. Yeah. What to speak about the bodies of others, sons, daughters, fathers, mothers, uncles, aunts, friends, so-called. None of them can help us at the time of leaving this body. Nobody. It's not possible. Even the body itself lets us down. So what is the solution? The solution is to find out the truth, to find out where real happiness lies, to find out who is the actual owner of everything, who is the controller of everything, and who is therefore the real enjoyer of everything, and then surrender ourselves to that personality. And as soon as we do that, all the misery is finished. Susukam kartamavyayam. This is the end result. Pratyaksha, it's directly perceivable. As soon as we get this Rajavidya, this knowledge of the soul and the Supreme Soul and their relationship, Sushukam, then we immediately become happy and satisfied. So this description here, of course, is about the materialists. A devotee, I mean, somebody can say, well, this is also happening to devotees. Their bodies are also failing. Yeah, even Srila Prabhupada had to put up with so many difficulties. Diabetes, heart palpitations, diseased kidney, uremia, hand swelling and leg swelling, high blood pressure, tremendous headaches, teeth falling out. Yeah. So what's the difference then? He's also apparently following the same situation here. No, for a devotee it's different. Although they have a material body, they don't identify with it. And therefore, when the body breaks down, they don't have any sense of loss. They don't have any lamentation. Because their happiness is secured on the transcendental platform, on the spiritual platform. And that remains even after this body is gone. So human life, the purpose of human life then, is to come to this point of reality. Yeah, pursue happiness. That's the goal. That's the meaning of life. But find it in the right place. Then you become peaceful, happy, and then you can have goodwill to all others. Okay, so we'll finish at that point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Vasudev Prabhu.
Thank you very much, Prabhu. You mentioned how one's capacity to enjoy does not increase with one's wealth.
Yes.
My question is, does our capacity to sin or to be promoted to higher realms increase with wealth? And also, does one's capacity for devotion, for spiritual progress, increase with one's wealth?
Well, that's two questions, sir. The first question is about the heavenly planets, yeah?
Or hell.
No, the position of the soul remains the same. His capacity remains the same. His capacity is that he is dependent. Although he's eternal, he's dependent. That's our capacity. That means that we cannot enjoy separately, we cannot increase our happiness, nor can it be decreased, actually. Whatever we are, we are. And our situation in the material world does not change the nature of the soul. The nature of the soul is sat, chit, and under. But as a dependent sat, chit, and under, not as a supreme sat, chit, and under. So in that way then, whether we're in Brahmaloka or whether we're in Patalaloka, the position of the soul doesn't change. It remains the same. Its capacity remains the same. If you take capacity as your potential, that's another way of saying it. So what is your potential? It's simply to be a servant of the Supreme. It's to be a servant of a superior. All the idea of, you know, increasing your happiness or decreasing it, this is all an illusion. That's all related to the body and the physical situation that we're in this material world. So even if we're on Brahmaloka or we're on the other end of the scale, that's not our natural position, to be in the material world. anywhere in the material world is an illusion. Real happiness and our real potential for our ability to fulfill our potential or capacity for happiness is only realized outside of this material universe or in connection with Krishna in this material universe. In which case, Prabhupada says that when you actually realize the nature of Krishna and you realize the nature of the soul, then you're not in the material world even if you appear to be. You see everything then as spiritual because it's all Krishna's energy. And that energy is deployed for the satisfaction of the devotees by Krishna. Just like he deploys Maya, yeah, to try to assuage our false demands for satisfaction. So he deploys his agent, Maya. All right, go and give him what he wants. I'll try, you know, let him try. But he also, when one surrenders to Krishna, he deploys his internal energy. All right, here's my devotee. Now give him everything, unlimitedly. So in the spiritual world, yes, everything is unlimited. And yet we are dependent and Krishna is independent. That's the difference. But both are unlimited.
My question also had to do with the fact that if I'm poor, I can hardly buy sex, buy intoxication. So wealth may allow me to perform so many sinful activities, or it may allow me to perform charity and give to the Brahmins or to the service of the Lord, and they promote me to a higher state. Whereas if I don't have...
Yes, so who is that me? Who is that me? You're saying, if I get more money, that will allow me to increase my enjoyment. If I get more money, it will allow me to give in charity. You don't have a brass tack to give to anybody. We don't have anything that we can give to anyone.
No, I mean, in terms of karma, can
I'm saying, karma? No, but I'm saying that sense of me, that's the problem. That sense of the false sense of I. If we understand we're not this body, we're not the mind, we're not the intellect, but we're spirit soul, that whole idea of increasing or decreasing disappears. When you know that you're an eternal part and parcel of Krishna and you're always dependent upon him, there's no question of me anymore. There's a question of Krishna, and then my part in that is how much satisfaction I can give to Krishna. And he reciprocates. That's all the devotee is worried about. How much I can give to Krishna as his part and parcel. So there's no question of gaining anything or losing anything. And Bhagavad Gita mentions that very specifically. That when one is situated on the transcendental platform, he has nothing to gain and nothing to lose. He sees gold and a stone as exactly the same. Everything becomes clear when you come to the transcendental platform. And then we get freed from that agitation that I need more. Or freed from the agitation that I'm losing something. When we're actually situated in Brahman, that sense of gain or loss is finished. It goes away. But that's how we can gauge whether we're making any advancement in spiritual life. We get freed from that, you know, hankering and lamenting. That's one of the symptoms. One becomes situated in the self, Atmarama. Becomes satisfied in the true self. That means as a particle of the supreme whole. That's the true self. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Manager, you give it the mic.
Prabhu, as devotees, we also have families, and there are always so many discussions about how the relationships in ISKCON need to be improved. And as a mother of somebody, of a son, I also experience how much what it takes to grow, to make somebody grow, especially when you want them to grow up nicely and in Krishna consciousness, and it takes a tremendous effort. So, what is the devotee's position? Because
the position is that we are playing a role. They're not our children, they're spirit souls. We've provided a circumstance by which they can take a body and then take up some activity again in this material world. But our position as devotees is to try to give that soul the opportunity to end that necessity of having to take another birth. All right? Give them one more body and then teach them how to not take another body when they leave it. So the sense of this is my child, this is my son, my daughter, that has to be modified. Yeah, this is a service that we're doing, or it should be seen as a service to another living being, to bring them also to the point of this Brahmagyan or transcendental knowledge. So the way that devotees interact with their families and children is entirely different than the way that a kami does. Yeah. We understand that this child is not my possession. Yeah. We have a duty to give them what we can according to our ability or capacity. And then beyond that, it's up to them. So we try to encourage them in different ways to become self-realized. Yeah. And then at a certain point, they're going to go off and do their own activities, etc. So one has to perform those duties with detachment. It doesn't mean neglect. Yeah, there is a genuine goodwill, as we've been explaining, from the parents to the children, and there should be goodwill from the children to the parents also. If it's situated on the right platform, goodwill will be there. But so detachment doesn't mean neglect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a neophyte, sometimes they think that, oh, now I'm spirit soul, I have nothing to do with this material world, so they just reject everything. That's not the position of a devotee. A devotee simply utilizes everything in Krishna's service. And because every other living being is a part and parcel of Krishna, they then offer them the opportunity to link up with Krishna also. So that is a service, it's a duty, if you like. But it's all connected with Krishna. But as soon as you forget Krishna, then the whole thing becomes a business of, you know, exchange. I'll do something for you, you do something for me. Then it's a business. It's not love. Real love is on the transcendental platform.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.